Happy Eastertide to everyone, and welcome to our final session with Professor John Wilson. It's been a wonderful series, and remember that if you missed a session, you can watch it online. Next week, Professor John Burgess from Pittsburgh Seminary is coming to talk about what is the Christian hope. And I hope you can all come back, because I think we need a little hope in this world today. And now, thank you, John Wilson, for this wonderful series, and thank you for opening us with prayer.
Let us pray. Dear Lord, with grateful thanks for the day and all it may bring to us, whether challenges or opportunities, or just a normal life of relaxation on a Sunday, we thank you for it. Now bless our hour together, and may our teaching and learning be acceptable in your sight. Amen. The portrait you see up is Richard Baxter, the most famous Presbyterian theologian, pastor. Should always say theologian, pastor, because there were others who were more altogether theologian, but Baxter was a pastor primarily. And he is the one who wrote The Reformed Pastor, which was a famous book from the time. It's still published, I noticed. And the book, when it first came out, I think it was 1658, relatively late for the Puritan period. And it was quite well accepted all around, also by the Anglican group and the Independents. Very much admired this book, and it has certainly solidified his reputation. I remember back in seminary hearing a professor quoting from this book, and the only quotation I remember is, "Be much at home and much in prayer," which is an interesting thing for him to have said. We go to the next slide. 1660, the restoration of the monarchy. What happened? Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell dies 1658. And he names his son Richard his successor. Richard does not have the authority that Oliver Cromwell had. And it becomes a problem. Things are not going well all around. There's a parliament, and it just so happens that final parliament is largely Presbyterian. Very interesting, after they've been pretty much excluded by the rump back when the Independents aided the army in getting rid of the king. Presbyterians were not anti-king. They were always hoping that something could be arranged with the king to preserve the monarchy, which did not happen. The king was executed. So things aren't going well. One of Cromwell's generals, it's General Monk. He has an army stationed up on the border with Scotland, and he marches into England and makes it known that he is opposing the current government. And the government organizes an army under its own general. They march toward Monk, but the whole army, the opposition army to Monk, disperses. There's not much left to fight with. So Monk becomes the effective dictator in England. And he makes an agreement with the royal party, with the royalists, to bring the king back. And it happens without much opposition at all. It kind of just gradually happens. The monarch is reestablished, 1660. So it's quite remarkable. And the Presbyterians, it's interesting to look at the history of what they're saying at this time. They are hoping that with Charles back, they're going to be favored. That's a hope. Doesn't turn out to be realistic at all, but the hope is there because the Presbyterians had been recognized as being in support of the king back when the king was killed. And they don't oppose the restoration of the monarchy. So there's some hope that because there are so many Presbyterians in the church, and because the structure of the church, generally speaking, has a Presbyterian flavor to it, always opposition from the independents, because the independents don't want a national church. They want all these pockets of congregations. That's all they want. Of course, it doesn't work like that. They always have a supervising body that decides who's qualified for ministry and who's not. So they have, in effect, a Presbyterian system because that's what Presbyteries do. They just say, well, now Presbyterian. The main thing is they don't want a national church. So there's hope that the Presbyterians are going to be the national church. That doesn't happen at all. The Church of England, as it was conceived under Elizabeth and under James and under Charles I, is restored. So the restoration of the church as it was before the Puritan period. But we have a declaration of pardon. You see that? That's important because they're not going to put people in jail or kill them because they were part of the Puritan group. Or the rightly say the group from Parliament, the parliamentary armies, or the Parliament itself that opposed the king. So a general pardon, except there's an exception made. Those who signed the death warrant of Charles I, there were 59, they are declared outlaws and they will be killed if caught. Many of them will be caught and executed in England. Many flee to the continent. And it's a famous case that two will flee to New England. And eventually, finally die there with their families. The Solemn League and Covenant is burned in public. That's what they think of the Presbyterians after they come in. It's a Roundwig rejection of the Presbyterians. So you think about that hope, the hope that they were, the church might be, the Church of England might be Presbyterian because it had been given this form, generally, so very many Presbyterians in the ministry, but absolute reversal. The Solemn League and Covenant made with Scotland and with the Scots Presbyterians, totally rejected. All former bishops are returned to office. So we're going back essentially to the church it was under James I, before we have a strong parliament, strong enough to assert itself against the king. So through the 1640s, 1650s. I should say, generally speaking, Charles II, the child of Charles I. Charles I had two sons that would inherit the monarchy. One is Charles II, the other one is James II, named for James I. Very interesting because these two guys, I shouldn't call them guys, should I? That's too royal for that, were. When Charles I was captured, and when he went through the whole process of capture and finally execution, sent his family to France, and they lived in the court of Louis XIV. Now, Louis XIV was an absolutist monarch, divine right of kings, and absolutely powerful. I mean, they had a parliament that had no power. The king was everything, absolutely everything. And this is what Charles II and James II are reared under, actually, in France. When they come back, they bring a lot of these ideas back with them. So we have not only royalist ideas, but also royalist morals, manners, should say manners, but actually it's morals. They both have a bad reputation for morals, especially James II. He's supposed to have a group of mistresses. I mean, not just one or two. He had a group. He had a favorite, but he also had a group. Charles too. Charles II had mistresses. In fact, Charles II will have a son, an illegitimate son that he will name Duke of Monmouth, and he will play a role in this history before we get to the end of it. All right, let's go to the next one. The Clarendon Code. Now here we have clear anti-Puritan, anti-Presbyterian lawmaking. Well, first of all, public office is restricted to those who receive Eucharist in the Church of England. Now, if you belong to the Church of England, theoretically that was everybody, right? You didn't have to declare yourself a member. You were a member by birth. You were in there just by belonging in a parish area. And you remember, a parish is generally a geographical political area with a church in it. So you're celebrating the Eucharist was the sign that you were a true member, and you could not be in public office of any kind, either at the low level of parish government or higher up. You couldn't belong to any of that without proof, and you had to have proof that you were taking Eucharist in the Church of England. Now, this restoration of the church, everything is restored. All the usages of the church, all the vestments, everything that was there under James and that the Puritans had objected to, all of that is restored. All right, the next thing you see is the oath required, allegiance to and supremacy, allegiance to the king and supremacy of the king, belief in the doctrine of passive obedience. Passive doctrine of passive obedience says that the subject is obedient even in cases of injustice, that the authority, in this case the king, certainly has absolute authority. And we know that Charles II and James II both claim divine right of kings, which meant implicitly that they had power over Parliament. Parliament, what power Parliament had, it had by virtue of asserting itself. And we've said before, it all begins back at Magna Carta centuries before. But it's like every century that followed, Parliament won a little more freedom, a little more right, a little more power to do something. And so it increased up until we get to Parliament in the Puritan period, which is a very strong Parliament, because the king is essentially out of the way. Parliament is in charge. When Charles I comes back, we get a Parliament that is completely under the hand of the king. And that's remarkable that the people accept this. They accept the complete restoration of the church, Church of England as it had been, and all of these laws, and the king with his questionable morality. I should also say something about Charles I, that he's responsible for founding these Carolinas. He was first established colonies in the Carolinas, financed it. He's also responsible for New York. James II, before he became king, was Duke of York. And Charles will award James the territory of New York that had been claimed by the Dutch. Remember that New York is originally Dutch. How did New York get to be English? There was a trade agreement. They had what the English traded off was a connection, a merchant connection with the Far East, where the Dutch wanted to very much get the English out of competition. They were not exactly sure where exactly. It wasn't China yet. They're not dealing with China, although China, they're European, certainly already in China. But it's could be India, Indonesia, somewhere in there. Didn't retain that in my mind exactly where. But there's a trade-off. And England gets New York. And it attaches, of course, to the New England colonies. And Charles will name a governor. And that governor is responsible for New England and New York. And didn't say it, but New York is named after the Duke of York, which will be James II. So that's where the name comes from. But this governor is a very repressive governor. The New England Puritans come under his control, and he is quite brutal when he wants to be. It's a very unhappy time. And so New England too will prosper when this series of kings, Charles and especially James, are gone. New England will benefit, will regain freedoms it did not have before. So this passive obedience, divine right. Go to the next slide. The Act of Uniformity, we've mentioned that, restores the Church of England as it was under James I, or we could also say as Elizabeth wanted it, Elizabeth the Queen, with all rights and usages, with the ordination of all ministers by bishops. Richard Baxter he is so prominent, he will be offered the office of bishop, which he will refuse. Very interesting. He'll refuse it. He will not take the office of bishop in the Church of England as it was being restructured. Of course, it would have meant he would have had to have been reordained under the Church of England. But he refused it. And Baxter will suffer persecution off and on for the next 30 years. It's a tragic history. He will run into, he won't do much. And there's one point where he writes something that's published where he is mildly critical of the Church of England, and he will be imprisoned for that. He will also face a judge called George Jeffreys. Now, this guy becomes famous for being a brutal judge. He would travel around to different communities and hold court for people who were making trouble for the state or for the church. And Baxter got hauled before this guy, and the way they describe him, I don't know if you've seen film of Nazi judges dressing down brutally people who stood in front of them, screaming at them to humiliate them. That's what we hear about this Judge Jeffreys when people were brought before him. And we can imagine Baxter growing quite old, also very frail, often ill, but having to face that kind of judge too. He'll be thrown into jail twice with bondages, requirements to get out of jail, put it enormous sums of money that he couldn't possibly pay. And when he's released, it's just kind of a, okay, we're releasing you. Don't do whatever you're doing. And sure enough, they would get him back in jail after some time. All right, the great objection. Ministers who refused to conform were ejected from the ministry in the Church of England. An estimated 2,000. Now you see different figures in the literature, but upwards of 2,000 it certainly was. And I say mostly Presbyterian. What we see in the literature is literature in opposition to the Church of England. Anything in opposition to the Church of England is blamed on the Presbyterians. So not the independents. And that's peculiar. I'm not sure why that is. I've never found an explanation. They blame the Presbyterians. The independents, perhaps it's because the independents never were a threat for the Church of England itself, because they had independent communities. Often they were indifferent to the church. Where they were not indifferent to the church was theoretically, as ministers of the Church of England, they receive salaries through Parliament. But we have a lot of those communities who were not taking that salary. That is independence. So in any case, we could say mostly Presbyterian, if not all Presbyterian, they're ejected. And this business of getting rid of the Presbyterians, king after king, James and then Charles, and also James II will say, James II, they all say Presbyterianism is a threat. Why is Presbyterianism a threat? Because it gives too much voice to the people, especially over against the divine right of kings. And Presbyterianism does intend to be a national church. That's what they intended at the time. They wanted to be the Church of England. So ordered, all the way up to assemblies. And we see that also in the work of Richard Baxter, that book, The Reformed Pastor. I mentioned this last time, and I mentioned it again. You can see in the book that it's Presbyterian and not independent, not congregational. Congregational at the time, they are the community of the committed. You're not in that community unless you have this big commitment, like the New England Puritans. You are, declare yourself part of the holy group. You behave like it. You have the spirituality of it. You are church. Whereas what we get with Richard Baxter and the Reformed Pastor, he's talking about a very broad church. And he says, most members in the church are weak. Whereas the independents always said, oh no, we're strong in faith. And they were. And Baxter's saying, most of the people are weak in faith. Who are the people? He's talking about the parish. He's talking about the people who are encompassed by the church and who are served by the church. And spiritually, certainly, part of the pastor's job is to reach out to these people. And this is in Baxter's book again and again and again. You go to the people who need it, and the people are in need. He has a very high standard for ministers. You read the book and you certainly see that. But you wouldn't find an independent minister particularly concerned about the people outside. They're concerned about certainly drawing those people in if they will come, but it's to be the core church of the saved. That's definitely the ideal of the original Congregationalists. So we have this great ejection. They're out. What are they going to do? Well, let's follow it a little further, the history. The next slide, the Conventicle Act. Now, this is where you suppress a religion. Gatherings of more than five people outside of the Church of England, prohibited. Now, it does make one exception for a family. So you have a family gathering, that's excluded. But the point is, five people gathered for some religious reason outside of the Church of England, prohibited. That was a reason for persecution, where that happened. I think Baxter at one point it falls under that one. What is it that keeps making noises? It's the mic. Sorry. Yeah, I could also hold it. Sorry about that. My vestments. So a great deal of persecution, also catching Baxter in this one. Very many ministers fell into persecution. And you see then, to avoid persecution was always staggered. You started out with a fine. Then the fine was increased, and then it went to imprisonment. And imprisonment for some shorter period of time than a longer period of time. So you definitely, ministers who were offended here faced definite persecution. And the more they offended, the worse the punishment. The 5 Mile Act. Expelled ministers may not come within 5 miles of a former parish. Now that's remarkable, isn't it? Is keeping your ministers away from your people. Or within 5 miles of any city, town, borough that sends members of parliament, sends members to parliament, unless an oath is taken never to resist the king or attempt to alter the government of church or state. So again, very restrictive. Go to the next one. 1672, there is a brief indulgence for all dissidents. That means for all of those who do not conform to the Anglican Church. Now, the reason for it is not that they were felt so nice toward the dissidents, but because there was a party under Charles and then very strong party under James II. James II was a Catholic, but a very strong party in favor of liberalizing laws for Catholics. So Catholics can take positions in the government, can be represented in the government. Now the Catholic population, people who had remained Catholic after all the whole parliamentary period, estimated at something less than 20% throughout the country, which is pretty much a pretty strong group. considering what the Catholics had to put up with under parliamentary government and Cromwell. But this is Charles's effort to include Catholics, and that's where we get the indulgence. So he tries to kind of sneak it in by giving an indulgence to everyone, to all the dissidents, the Protestants too. And the reaction is so strong that it's repealed. Now, in this brief period, Richard Baxter will form a new congregation, and actually very quickly a church is built. In 1673, it's all lost, everything's gone. So this little indulgence, which was meant essentially for the Catholics by Charles II, benefited the Protestants, but then it's all reversed. Everything's reversed. Goes back to the way it was, same old exclusion of Puritans and Presbyterians. 1673-78, Estacs. In public office, the military, and Parliament, Catholics are prohibited. Now, this is something the kings don't want, but Parliament puts through. And Parliament is kind of off and on in favor of the kings, or in favor of itself being a strong Parliament. But they pick this up. Catholics are prohibited in public office, military, and Parliament. Now, it's a reaction to what had happened in 1672 with that indulgence. Very interesting that it happens at all, but it definitely happens. Parliament is strong enough to assert it against the king. For all others, Eucharist in the Church of England is required. University attendance, the degrees from the universities, only with Eucharist in the Church of England. So again, dissidents cannot attend university. It's kind of going back just the way it was before that indulgence in 1672. So we're right back to where we were before, except now it's very much focused on Catholics. Now, the always have to remember the persecution under Mary, Queen Mary. The English certainly never forgot that. Fox's Book of Martyrs remained a very popular read. It had to do with the martyrdoms under Catholic Queen Mary, who tried to reverse Reformation to make England Catholic again. That remained very, very strong in English memory, whether Puritan, Presbyterian, or Church of England, it certainly was there. And so we have this strong, always anti-Catholic bias on the part of the Protestants and generally the Church of England. Let us say in the population, the general population, is not friendly to Catholicism because of that past history. All right, then in 1683, the Rye House Plot. This is a group of Protestants who will, in a very unsuccessful way, plot to kill the king. And it totally fails. And it results in a very harsh persecution. Charles II I'm sure he had several illegitimate children, but one that he had early on with a favorite mistress, he made Duke of Monmouth. And this Duke of Monmouth is identified for some reason that I haven't been able to find out, identified with the Protestants and not the Catholics. And so the Protestant group are looking to this Duke of Monmouth, this illegitimate child of Charles II, to lead a revolution against the king. And this happens. There will be an army formed in the wake of the Rye House plot in connection with it. And that army is severely defeated, and the Duke of Monmouth is executed. And then there's a new persecution because of the support for this revolution on the part of certain areas of England. There's a new persecution, and some of it is quite brutal to suppress anything that looks like revolution. And then royalist efforts to control Parliament. Parliament has been, again, asserting itself over against the king in terms of its own rights. And the king will devise, king and his advisors advise ways, invent ways to get control of Parliament. That's very interesting, the way they do it. They declare the different charters that have been given to the different areas of England to elect members of Parliament, declares all of those charters ineffective. Let's say it outlaws them. It says they are no longer valid. We're going to have you choose Parliament according to a charter that we determine. And this new charter is clearly favored royalist candidates, not people who were independent or people who were not royalist, who were more inclined to the old Puritan ways. They had no chance at all of getting elected. And this becomes a new way that monarchy has of controlling the government and suppressing what's left of Puritanism. Go to the next slide. 1685, 1688, James II. And here we get a new rebellion and a new persecution. James is completely Catholic, and he makes no bones about it. And it becomes quite clear that he wants, as much as possible, to return England to Catholicism. And he his formation of different government offices and so forth favor this. He puts people in who agree with him. And so we have this renewed effort to Catholicize, rebellion, persecution. Now, the rebellions that happen, the attempts to rebel, are all relatively weak. They're not well organized. And where are they going to get a great deal of support? They don't. Outside of England and outside of a few principalities in Germany, where those principalities are Protestant, you have divine right of kings and Catholicism in charge just about everywhere. So it's they don't find real support. So they all collapse. 1687, 1688. Declaration of Tolerance. Again, the whole purpose, James II is trying to get Catholics into office. So he declares a general toleration, also including other dissidents, including the old Puritans, the old Presbyterians, tolerating them. But the purpose is clearly to get Catholics into office. And this is why it's resisted. The people resist this, also certainly what's left of Presbyterianism and the independency resisted. Not because they don't want the toleration for themselves, but because they don't want these Catholics in office. And James is pretty clear. He wants to re-Catholicize. And what he says is, once the people just get used to it, the people just get used to being Catholic, they will accept it. So all we have to do is impose it, they'll get used to it, and then we won't have a problem. That was, we know he said things like that. So there we have the Glorious Revolution, William and Mary. I'm sure all of you learned about that in school, right? That's not something entirely new. The Glorious Revolution, William and Mary. William is William of Orange. He is a Protestant prince. He sees the opportunity in England to invade and to overcome the government of James. And he takes the opportunity and he comes in. And then we get the Toleration Act for Protestant dissidents to accept, Supremacy Act with the doctrine of the Trinity required. That is, any Protestant dissenting group that doesn't accept the doctrine of Trinity is not accepted. And then Presbyterianism legitimated for Scotland. That's a promise they're not going to interfere in Scotland anymore. But let me, before we go to the next slide, Mary, who is Mary? Actually, she is the one that has the authority when they come into England, when William and Mary come. She's the daughter of James II. She is a daughter of James II, reared as a Protestant, and she stays Protestant in spite of her father. In spite of her father's devotion to Catholicism, she's not. One thing is she's reared in England under the Church of England, not in France under Louis XIV. So it's interesting that she comes in as the queen. Now, William of Orange will be declared king. Do I say that in the next slide? If not, I want to say it now. Yes, let me say it now. William will be declared king by the Parliament. Now that's interesting right there. They could have just stuck with Mary, that Mary was queen. They were getting everything they wanted from Mary. Why then make a William king? Well, they needed a strong representative of a European army. They're talking about the Dutch. The Dutch were very much, Dutch Protestants very much behind this. But William is also a very strong military leader. And it's in recognition of all that, they declare him king. Now, it's very interesting because William is not being declared king because he is a legitimate ruler, although he has some claim to it. I'm going to come to that. It's Parliament making a declaration. And some books say that this is the most decisive thing that happens in the Glorious Revolution, that Parliament now has won the right to name a king, that it comes from it's the population elects the Parliament elects the king. Now that's different. That's not divine right. Divine right is, I am king because my father was king. My father was king because his father was king. And it goes on the way back. Divine right of kings. Well, William becomes a very strong monarch. He's a good military leader. And James will organize an army to fight in England and with French help, and is defeated in England. And he leaves, goes to France, back to his place where he had come from, so to speak, before. And he will organize a new army. And his point of invasion is Ireland, Northern Ireland. And that's when we get the Battle of the Boyne. William will face against Charles the Battle of the Boyne, and William wins. Like I said, he was a good general. He wins, and Charles is forced to flee. Excuse me, James, forced to flee, goes back to France, where he kind of will spend the rest of his life close to the court in France. But that's where we get this big division of the orange. I don't know if you ever experienced that, that people on St. Patrick's Day, instead of dressing in green, will dress in orange. You ever seen that? It's an old Presbyterian tradition that goes back to William of Orange. That was his title before he became King of England, William of Orange. And that orange becomes the color of the Protestants in Northern Ireland, still there, and generally of Presbyterianism, for the people who know that tradition of dressing in orange on St. Patrick's Day. What else is there to say about what's happening now? A general toleration of Protestantism. Let's go to the next page. Yes, maybe I've left out something. Let me see what you have. Yes, I didn't copy this for myself. All the test acts remain in effect. So we don't get any benefit other than a general toleration. We're not going to persecute you, but we're not going to favor you. All the test acts remain. Requirement that public officials must be active in the Church of England is not retracted until 1727. Nonconformists and Catholics could not matriculate at Oxford or Cambridge until 1871. So, absolutely no favoritism for the dissidents. What happens to Presbyterianism under this kind of regime? Well, what do you think? It just kind of slowly dwindles. Not in Scotland. Scotland's strengthened. But in England, there is no favoritism for it anywhere. Not even attendance in the universities. Can't be public officials. So they're pushed to the sidelines. Now, I have never read anywhere about a migration of English Presbyterians to America. The only thing I see is that sometimes they are mixed in with the congregation that's going to New England. That's all I see. So we wind up with this tradition that Presbyterianism comes to us through the Scots-Irish and through Scotland. The other history is just not there. I find that very strange. Surely they must have been part of the migration, but you don't migration to the Carolinas, migration into New York, whatever, Virginia. We just don't see any talk about Presbyterians. It's not mentioned. And so what we see is that they just dwindle away. Today, the Presbyterians are a minority group, very much a minority group in England. The Congregationalists managed to survive too. They will unite. Today, they're a united church, United Reformed Church of Britain. Some Congregational churches stayed out of the union. Some Presbyterian churches stayed out of the union. Either way, they are small groups relative to the Church of England. Now, Church of England certainly not doing well either. But far, far more people involved in the Church of England than either in this Reformed, United Reformed Church, or Congregational or Presbyterian Church of England. So it just dwindles away. If I've read anything in history that reminds me of it, it's Muslim conquest of Christian areas. In Christian history, we have major Muslim conquests, for example, of Egypt. Egypt was entirely Christian. And then Constantinople, the whole of what is today Syria, Lebanon, Constantinople, what is today Turkey, not all of that was Christian. And it's taken over by the Muslims and is all today still Muslim. What happens to Christianity under the Muslims? The Muslims declare, this was very important, and you see it today in literature when they talk about how humane the Muslims were. They tolerate Christianity. They don't oppose it. You can exist. What can you not have? What is their way of not favoring Christianity? Christians can't hold power. They can't hold political office. And they can't have too much wealth. So all of that remains Muslim. But what happens to the Christian communities under those kinds of situations? They dwindle. They're not gone, but they dwindle. We don't have these large Christian church communities that were there before the Muslim conquest. That's what it looks like now in England. Everything is Church of England, to the detriment of Presbyterians and Congregationalists, which is it's remarkable. They will establish their own schools. They cannot establish universities, but they establish their own schools, something like university education. They're quite good schools, we're told. But it just simply dwindles. Nothing like what was there before, nothing like what they hoped for. I go to this last one. Now put these up. Queen Anne, she is also a daughter of James II. And she is weird Protestant, and she never decides in any way she's in favor of the Catholics. She is pure Church of England. She's for all of those acts that repress the Puritans and the Presbyterians. All of that stays in effect. She in no way favors Puritans, old Puritans, or Presbyterians. They are not favored. She is purely Church of England. She will marry a nobleman. I think it's the King of Denmark. She will have a child, a boy, who should have been the heir and the next king, but he will die fairly young. I think he dies at 12. So she dies without a child. And then we get this entry of the German line of Hanover into the English monarchy, George I. Why George I? Well, he is a cousin by way of a daughter of James I. Way back, she marries with a king of a relatively small kingdom in Germany, and he will is related to the House of Hanover. And so it goes like this to get to George. George winds up being the last legitimate Stuart king, because he's related. He's related legitimately back to James I through James's daughter, and James's the daughter's son marries and has this son, George, who becomes King of England. So a very roundabout way, and we get the Hanover line that's still in existence of the kings and queens of England. They don't like the German connection. They don't talk much about Hanover. And I remember a duke of Battenberg. That was an inheritance from the German line, the Duke of Battenberg. They changed the name. Do you know enough German to recognize how they changed it? Battenberg. They changed it to Mountbatten. I think it was even a stronger English Anglicization than that. So I'm sorry I mentioned that. It's just confused. All right, Whigs and Tories. This is where we get the Whigs and Tories. Whigs, Parliament. Tories, King. Tories favor the monarchy, strong monarchy, ruled by the monarchy. Whigs, Kings. This comes over into the American tradition too. We even had a Whig party at one time in the American tradition. And what Whigs traditionally stand for is democracy, more democracy. The Tories certainly more for kings. And you'd be surprised if you look at the next century, the centuries following in the literature, who was Tories and who were Whigs. Tories had some very strong intellectuals. David Hume, the great philosopher, was a Tory. I'm trying to think of the name of the literary figure, great literary figure from the time, was also a Tory, but the name escapes me. But I stop here, and I want to reflect a bit back with you on what's happened, the loss, so to speak, of the Puritan Presbyterian tradition. It just disappears. Always with the memory that the Anglican Church, the Church of England, is in its theology Reformed Protestant. Where it's not Reformed Protestant is in its vestments and ceremonies, those things that the Puritans said, these things are going to lead back to Catholicism. Do we ever see it leading back to Catholicism? And the answer to that is yes. It'll happen, especially in the 19th century. We get the Oxford movement. John Henry Newman, famous figure of the Oxford movement, where they clearly celebrate Catholic tradition. And to the detriment of the traditional theology. And we get a division inside the Anglican Church, pro-Oxford movement, that's pro-Catholic, a tendency to Catholicize as much as possible the Church of England. And on the other hand, bishops solidly against this, they want to stay and remain Protestant. John Henry Newman, famous figure of this period, will become Catholic and will be named a Catholic cardinal. And out of this, we get high Anglo-Catholicism, where one part of the Catholic Church is very, very close to Catholicism, to the point of communion with each other, but without complete union. So what does the world lose by losing the Puritan Presbyterian tradition? Well, an interesting, John Wesley descends from Puritans, his family, founder of Methodism. His great-grandfather was a Puritan, independent. Very solid, very much so, not in the least in favor of the Anglican tradition as it was under King James I and under Elizabeth, the pure Puritan. His son is involved in the restoration of the kings, and he becomes a royalist. Much in favor of the king. And his son becomes the father of John Wesley. He's father of Wesley is a minister in the Anglican Church. His wife was reared in a tradition that definitely was influenced by the old Puritanism. So Wesley comes out of a tradition that is interestingly mixed, clearly mixed with Puritanism in the line he stands in, the birth line. such an interesting study to look at his family heritage. Of course, he was raised completely within the Church of England. And even as a Methodist, he never separated Methodists from the Church of England. He kept them always inside the Church of England. Well, there's much we can reflect on. One of the sources that I read made a major point of saying, what really distinguished the Puritans? And we include Presbyterians in that general movement. What distinguished them most? And the source said it was the glory of God and the worship of God, that it was so much centered on the glory of God and the worship of God, that it had in that itself a reaction against vestments and ceremonies, that its focus was clearly New Testament, that all it did and tried to do with the church came through the New Testament, was based on the New Testament, and everything else that the Church of England included, vestments, ceremonies, and so forth. All of those things were things that grew up through the centuries and were superfluous and detracted. And the old argument was, you keep it, it's going to lead to Catholicism. Now, that has happened and it has not happened. But there I stop and ask if you have any questions or comments at this point. I hope I've been clear. I think sometimes I'm not clear at all, but I'm clear in my own mind anyway. Questions, comments? Have you learned? Or have you confused?
There's a lot to unpack. During the time period in the 1600s, where the Puritans and the Presbyterians were getting knocked back, wasn't that a strong period for the Scottish Presbyterians in terms of education and the growth intellectually of Scotland?
Yes, Edinburgh has grown. It cannot yet hold a candle to Oxford and Cambridge. They will get there in the following two centuries. The Scottish universities will be on a par with what's happening at Cambridge and Oxford. And they will have a more reputation for being more progressive when they get there. Especially Oxford has a reputation for being backward, very, very conservative. Like everybody has to learn Latin, everybody has to be tested in Latin. So the sciences come in only slowly and find the recognition they need to develop only slowly. Also, Oxford and Cambridge, class plays a huge role, social class. Aristocrats, high level, middle class, always favored. Just the history of education itself. There are histories of the education spirit, histories of the universities. Very interesting because of this, the degree to which they open to the sciences, the degree to which they open to dissidents, the dissidents can come. So as you see, it's late 19th century before anybody associated with Presbyterianism, calling themselves Presbyterian, can go to a university. And it's not just Oxford and Cambridge. Think in the 19th century, Durham is there. And it's the same thing with Durham, same restriction. So it's severely restricted for a long time, Very oddly so. We come to America, we have this complete freedom. So much so that, and it's very good that, although certainly Presbyterianism is Scotch-Irish, there are the Scots who went to Ireland. It's almost a pure Scottish group that will come into America. But today, Presbyterianism is hardly and rightly not associated just with Scots, Irish, or Scots. It is international. Presbyterian Church is an international church, rightly so, and that's good. But it's not bad to look at the history of what happened. So an English Presbyterianism that we hardly hear anything about anymore, as good as completely suppressed. Thank you.